An anguished cry is in the hearts of most of us as believers at some time or another. Am I truly a Christian? Will I ultimately inherit eternal life? Or will I not? And how will I know?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, an honest and sincere and very difficult question that comes to the minds of many, many, if not all believers, is how can I know that I really am saved? How can I know that I really am a true believer? I look at my life and I see lots of evidence that maybe I am. But on the other hand, I see evidence that maybe I'm not. It's a scary thing for people.
One of the mistakes I think that gets made by a lot of students of the Bible, a lot of Bible teachers, a lot of Christians in their own understanding of their faith, is that we ought to be able to answer that question by taking a snapshot of my life and examining the snapshot. You know, I look at my life right now and I look for the marks that I really am an authentic believer. But I think, if I'm understanding things rightly, the answer that the Bible gives to that is rather that the only way we can ultimately tell whether we are a true, authentic child of God is in the long term, is over the long haul of my life. And the issue is your believing something that is authentic enough that it will remain, that it will abide, or what sometimes theologians and Bible students call perseverance. Will I persevere in my faith, in my belief?
Not did I curse God today because I was so disappointed, or did I get angry at God today because some difficult thing happened in my life, or did I question God today because my life isn't going the way I thought it was going to go or how I think even God wants it to go. But rather, when I look over the long haul of my life, am I eventually answering the question, yes, I want God. Yes, I value what He values. Yes, I want to go in that direction.
Yeah, and not only eventually, but kind of inevitably. Answering it that way. Is there something in me that just won't let me walk away from this? Is there something in me that just cannot say no to God?
Even though I might say no for a period of time.
Yeah, out of fits of anger and temper and for periods of time. And
or loss or grief or confusion.
Yeah, right. One of my favorite passages, and I can't prove that this is what's going on, but it sure reads that way to me. You have the account of Jesus feeding the 5,000, multiplying the bread and the fish and feeding the 5,000. And then they follow him to the other side of the lake and they ask him basically to do that again. would you multiply some more bread and feed it? And Jesus gives a response to them that's really kind of bizarre. You know, unless you drink my blood and eat my flesh, you cannot, or I guess it's just unless you eat my flesh, you cannot have any part of me, and so on. And at the end of that passage, that's the one where he says, I am the bread of life. At the end of that passage, John records that many of the disciples left, departed. That is, that just got too weird hearing what Jesus had to say, and they split. And John records that as many of the disciples left, he turned to the 12, to the chosen 12 disciples, and he said, will you leave too? And I think it's Peter who's recorded as saying, Lord, where would we go?
Yeah.
You have the words of eternal life. Now, what I can't prove is, if I'm reading Peter's mind, it's, I would love to go elsewhere, Jesus. This is just too bizarre. I would love to leave, but where am I going to go? Because what you have to say and who you are and what you represent is just too real, too substantial, too much what I need for me to go looking anywhere else. And that it seems to me, is the mark that we are being sanctified, that we are being set apart for this unique destiny that the children of God have, is that there's something in us, some reality within us, that just drives us toward God ultimately. And as much as emotionally, psychologically, in many other ways, we would love to go another way, God is just not making me happy, He's not convenient, He's interfering in my life, He's spoiling all kinds of things. But in spite of all that, where are we going to go? Because He's got the words of life.
I'm compelled by His words of life. I want them. I'm driven by them, even though it's difficult to live in them.
Exactly, yeah. So what that reality within us, that driving force toward God means, is that, let me back up for a second. We experience that as almost an imposed reality. At least speaking for myself, I think I've probably shared an event in my own life where this really came to the fore. I had failed a midterm in college, and my grade point average was my God, was my idol, and God had just smashed my idol and ground it to bits under His heel. And I was faced with the question, what am I going to do here? This God who I'm purporting to serve has just treated me very, very badly. And am I going to continue to serve Him, or I'm going to split? And it was not an easy decision for me. It was a very, very difficult decision for me. But in a way that's almost inexplicable to me, well, it is inexplicable to me, to this day, I have no explanation for why I remained a believer, except that God wasn't going to let it be any other way. God just wanted me, He had me, and He was going to keep me in His hand.
Kind of in spite of yourself.
In spite of myself, yeah. And it's that sense that gives the confidence that I'm a child of God, when I recognize my belief is not coming from me, really. I'm not believing because I want to believe. I'm believing because God wants me to believe. And it's that sense of the gap between where I would go naturally and where I have in fact gone that I think is how we get that sense of confidence that you were asking about at the beginning. How do I know that I'm a believer? Because I don't have anything to do with this. Because God is turning me into a believer. He's making me a believer. He's got a hold of me, and I can't get away.
And so one of the marks of being a Christian is that I persevere in believing. And yet what I usually hear, my mind says, is, well, I have done the persevering. But what you're saying is, no, God is persevering in making me believe.
Right.
And I look at my life and see, ah, I have persevered. But ah, it is God who has persevered to make me a persevering
right.
person.
Exactly. Exactly right. And that's a very important distinction. I can remember when I was going away to college, I had grown up in a culture that was, you know, really pretty conservative, Bible-believing culture. You might even say fundamentalistic culture. And really, from where I was coming from, a kind of a farming community, an agrarian community, it was not a really high-powered intellectual culture that I came from. It wasn't an East Coast prep school background. And yet I got accepted to Stanford University and was going to go away to school at Stanford University. I just barely had any knowledge of that world and that culture out there. I mean, it was a whole world that I had never experienced before. High-powered, intellectual, academic, high-cultured people. I mean, a lot of my dorm mates were from East Coast prep schools. I'd never met a preppy in my entire life.
You must have seemed like such a hick there.
Oh, it was just amazing. The most comforting thing is when my roommate drove up on a motorcycle and came in with cowboy boots from Merced, California, with a twang. I thought, I can relate to this. This will be okay.
Oh, good. He might have been the only other cowboy on campus, but you got him, and that's good.
Yeah. But I just knew enough about what I was getting into that I can remember consciously saying to myself, okay, Jack, you're going to go down to a godless, secular university, and they are not going to like your faith, and they are going to attack your faith, and they're going to try to take your faith away from you. Jack, don't let them do that. And I think I was thinking very much along the lines of what you suggested, that I saw keeping my faith as my responsibility. It's something, it was going to be some virtue in me that just hung on to it no matter what. And I think I even really kind of realized at the time, remember I didn't have my adult brain yet, but to the degree that I had any brain at all, I think I sort of realized what the stakes might be. The stakes might be that I'm going to have to become dogmatic. I'm going to have to just believe anyway, even if I don't have good reasons to believe, even if all of their arguments are compelling and I really shouldn't believe, the right thing for me to do is to believe anyway.
Well, you're clenching both your fists as though you were thinking, I've got to get rigid, I've got to get hard, I've got to put on my armor and stand firm, otherwise they'll snatch it away from me. Yeah. I've got to protect myself.
I believe in justification by stubbornness.
Yeah, or perseverance by stubbornness.
Yeah. Just be stubborn and don't let them do it.
Close your eyes.
Now, thank God, and I say this with all sincerity, thank God I couldn't have been stubborn enough. I mean, I believed too much in God-given reason and that truth was going to be reasonable and truth should make sense and truth should be compelling. So, as I look back, I really couldn't have kept the faith that I had then, as flawed as it was and as immature as it was and as unbiblical as it was. I really couldn't have kept that faith in the face of the intellectual challenges that were there. But even though I couldn't have kept it through stubbornness, what I learned instead is that the way we persevere in the faith is God keeps us. God gives us answers. God enlightens us. God brings us understanding, and what is compelling, the truth that is compelling, reveals itself and manifests itself as such. And that was more my experience. But I can't take any credit for that. It was God taking my hand and leading me through the process.
Well, I have another story that this reminds me of. May I share it?
Sure.
It's about my college experience, and but it's kind of the opposite thing. I went to my first year of college, I went to a secular university, and during that time, some adults in my life, actually the pastor of my church, said, Christine, you really must go to a Christian college. If you don't, you may lose your faith. I remember his wife saying to me, Christine, you're like a rose, and a rose is very fragile, and it needs a good environment for it to open up. If you don't have that environment, you may just shrivel and never bloom. I remember those words pretty clearly and thinking, oh my heavens, I better go to a Christian college or I may lose my faith. But paradoxically, in that Christian college was the biggest, I had the biggest struggle ever in my faith, because what they were presenting to me as I saw it was not important. Things that they were majoring on were minors in my mind. And at that point, using your language, I didn't have an adult mind, and I couldn't understand it, I couldn't articulate it, but it didn't seem right to me. It didn't seem right to me. I remember one time, there was a dress code, and we had to have our dresses, I think it was not more than a couple of inches above our knees at the time, and at that point in time, miniskirts were in. And I was walking by the dean of women's office one day, and she called me inside, and she made me get down on my knees, got out a ruler, and measured the hem of my skirt. Well, it was about a quarter of an inch above where it should have been, and she told me to, in no uncertain terms, Christine, you go back to your dorm, and you take off that dress, you put on something more appropriate, and never wear that dress again. I was really shamed by that, and I was really angered by it. Because although, yes, I had broken the code, though I hadn't known it, it felt to me like it was inappropriate. It was not essential. It was not necessary. And I never was called in by that woman and said, I like the way you're pursuing your faith. I like what I'm seeing in your life. What I heard was this punitive, you better have your skirt exactly the right height. And that was kind of how that whole experience was. That's an example of how I experienced my school, majoring on the minors. And I walked out of that school confused because I couldn't figure out what real Christianity was about, because that couldn't be it in my mind. And what really brought me around was I met my husband Larry, and he was asking the same questions I was, and yet he had some good answers. I was absolutely compelled to go in his direction. I just couldn't get enough of him because he was talking about real things, what I thought really could matter to God. He was talking about love and mercy and justice, and he was dealing with me in a way that was very loving and very giving and very compassionate and very forgiving. My heart just soared toward that. So, in spite of my experience, God helped me persevere in my faith, because I could have pushed against it in ultimate rebellion.
And very understandably so, you're saying. Because what was being portrayed to you was really, in the final analysis, so completely contrary to what really is important, what really is true.
And I don't think they maybe intended that. I think they would say things that Larry, my husband, was telling me are really what they were after. But I didn't hear it in that context. I couldn't find it. And looking back, I still can't find it. I found it in my husband. I found it in the way he related to me. Mm-hmm. And so it was God that brought Larry into my life, really, and helped me persevere in a faith that I could have blown away at that point.
Mm-hmm. Since our examples have taken us in this direction, I think it would be worth addressing a particular issue, and that is the difference between sanctification and socialization. Those are radically different things. Many, many Christians want to send their children into what we might call the hothouse environment, you know, the fragile
school.
Rose that you were that needed the right environment. Is what they're saying true? Yes. That there is a tendency to for students out of a Christian home, when they go to the secular university, there certainly is a tendency for them to lose their faith, if you will. Why? Because they, at the secular university, they don't have what a sociologist would call a plausibility structure. A plausibility structure is that network of people and that network of institutions in your life that all kind of agree with a certain set of beliefs and a certain set of values, and because they are all in agreement on that, it's easy for you to believe it. It's easy for you to just fall in line and accept it.
Your culture buoys you up.
Yeah, yeah. Your culture supports you in a certain direction rather than resists you. Well, a Christian going to a secular university does not have much of a plausibility structure at all. Everything at the university is resisting your believing God and Christianity and having faith. So is it safer to send a student to a Christian university where there is a plausibility structure, where the faculty and the other students and the whole structure of the school assumes the things that of faith and the belief in God and the truth of Christianity and so on? Sociologically speaking, yes. Because there is that plausibility structure, it's a lot easier for a Christian student to kind of remain a Christian. The problem is that misses the whole point, and that is the belief that the New Testament is requiring of us, the faith that marks us as a child of God, is not a faith that we have because everybody around us has that faith. It's a faith that, when it's tested, can't go away and won't go away. It's a supernatural faith. It's a spirit-produced faith. It's a miraculously produced faith. It's a faith that puts there, and no amount of opposition, no lack of plausibility structure, no resistance by the world can possibly make it go away if it's authentic and if it's real. That, I think, is what the Bible is talking about when it says perseverance is such an important indicator that my faith is authentic. Because as we go through life, we're going to find ourselves in a lot of different situations, and some of those situations are going to be very, very unsupportive of our faith and very hostile to our faith, antagonistic toward it. Do we have the kind of faith that when we meet opposition and hostility and antagonism, my faith doesn't go away? Yeah. Well, then how do we explain that? Because it's a real faith. Because it's authentic. It's a faith that God has put there, not a faith that my family has put there, that my church has put there, that my community has put there, that I've just kind of absorbed from my environment, but rather it's a faith that the Spirit of God Himself has produced there, and that faith doesn't go away when it meets opposition.
So I don't have to fear where I send my children to school.
Not really. I mean, it's true. Let me back up for a second. Frankly, I think there are a lot of Christians who would rather that their children, I'll put this starkly, but I think this is true, they would rather that their children remain Christians and lose their soul than depart from Christianity and find it. That's a terrible choice.
Okay, but
I think it really is true that they're not aware of making that choice, but that really is the choice that they're making.
Well, let's define what you're saying, because I think that could be difficult. Could you repeat it first, and then let's see if we can break it down a little bit. I absolutely agree with you.
I think there are parents who find what's really motivating, what's really interesting to them, even though I think they are not aware of it, is that they would rather that their children remain Christians and lose their soul than that they lose their Christianity and gain their soul, find their soul. And what I mean by that is, let me speak to my own children. It would be far better for my children to go away to college and have their faith challenged and all of a sudden realize, boy, I don't know. Just because my old man believes it doesn't mean I should believe it. I'm not so sure he's right. Look at all these interesting things out there in the world. I think I'll go experiment with them and see if maybe they aren't truer than this thing that my old man was believing all my life. And so they say, I'm not a Christian any longer. And they go out and they start experimenting with some other things. As a parent, it's going to rip my heart out to see that happen.
Absolutely, rip your heart out.
It's devastating. But at that point, I really need to recognize, but what do I want them to do? To continue believing their whole life because I believe? To continue believing their whole life just not to disappoint me? Well, that would be a terrible reason to believe, because that's not authentic. There's no real faith there. There's no real faith that God has put there. And therefore, there's no mark that they're really a child of God. Far better that they lose their faith only to come to a dead end in their life, turn around and go, you know what? Why would I run away from Jesus? He has the words of eternal life. And come back to Him and finally make a decision that's their decision, that they embrace with their whole being the eternal life that Jesus promises. Surely I would rather have that than that they go away to some Christian college, live in a plausibility structure that supports them in believing that Christianity is true and believing that they are a Christian, and then go from there to a church that supports them in that, and spend their whole life with a faith that's propped up by a plausibility structure, and never once in their life have they ever come to authentic faith. That would be a tragedy of tragedies.
And not coming to authentic faith is where we don't ever gain our soul.
Exactly, exactly.
Because what we've done is we've taken on something that looks good and seems right, but it has never entered into our hearts, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
So when you say you'd rather lose that your child would rather, how did you put it?
I would rather have them lose their Christianity.
Lose their Christianity. You're not really meaning a true faith. You'd rather them lose their false pretense of what even looks real in order for them to gain what truly is real and authentic faith. And only then do we gain our soul.
Exactly. Exactly.
And in that, rightly understood, I completely agree with you. I think how people could misunderstand that is, why would you ever want somebody to stop being a Christian? And you're not saying they were true Christians, that they were true believers. You're saying it looked like true belief, but it was never tested.
Right.
And it is only in the testing of our faith that we see whether it's authentic or whether it is not.
Right. And, you know, coming all the way back to the question you started with, how do we know that my faith is real? Another way of asking that question is, how do I know whether the faith that I have is really mine, coming from within me and authentically embracing the truth of the gospel, and not just something I believe because it so happens that everyone around me believes, and why not? Because the first is authentic and means I'm a child of God and means I have eternal life. The second doesn't mean that at all. The second is worthless in the final analysis if it doesn't go any deeper than just being a reflection of the faith of everybody around me. Then it's not mine. And it doesn't mean that I'm a child of God. It just means that some of the people around me are children of God. But that doesn't do me any good.
So how would somebody know? Is this just a reflection of the beliefs around me? Is this just a reflection of my parents' beliefs? Or is it truly mine?
Yeah, and that's where I say, we can't know that by taking a snapshot of my life right now and saying, okay, how intensely do I think this? Or how sincerely do I believe this? Or how am I honest when I say that I think this is true? We can't really ultimately assess those things. But what we can see is that over the course of the time, as I go through what the Bible calls trials and tribulations, as I go through those times in my life where I am severely being seduced by the world to go another direction, or I'm being so hated and I meet such antagonism in the world that my faith becomes very uncomfortable and very inconvenient. Those are the trials and tribulations of life. When I face various trials and tribulations over the long haul, do I find that I just can't not believe? No matter what comes my way, no matter what I experience, the only thing that's really certain and the only thing that really is the bottom line for me is this gospel thing is true. If that's what I find, then there's one and only one explanation. My faith is authentic, and it was put there by God.
And I really, I guess where it's not very secure is when I'm a very young person, because my faith really has not been tried. I haven't been through life. I couldn't have been through that much life at age 19. I mean, some 19-year-olds have been through one whole lot more life than other 19-year-olds. But generally speaking, I still have years ahead of me to see where life, what life does to me and the decisions I make out of where I have to go, where I'm brought by God.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the biggest mistakes that I think that I've seen Bible teachers make is to want to try to alleviate the uncomfortable situation that a young believer is in, where they are really are uncertain about their faith. And they want to come along and give them an answer and
make them feel real secure.
Yeah, make them feel secure and make them comfortable. You're a believer, and let me let you be comfortable in your knowledge that you're a believer. And so I can remember being taught as an early believer the assurance of salvation, where we would memorize Bible verses that say you can be sure. And I went to a Bill Gothard seminar where Bill Gothard said, here's how you deal with doubts. If you have a doubt that you're a believer, get down on your knees and ask Jesus to come into your heart. And take out a stake, a wooden stake, and write the date on that stake that you sincerely asked Jesus in your life. And you take that stake and you go and you pound it in the ground behind the barn. And then whenever you have any doubts ever again, whether or not you're really a believer, you go out behind the barn and you look at that stake and you remember that on that date, you sincerely ask Jesus in your heart. Jesus said he would come in if you ask him. Jesus doesn't lie. There you go. Even at the time that he was teaching that antidote to my uncertainty, there seemed to be a logical flaw in what he was saying, and that is, it all depends upon whether I rightly assessed whether I was sincerely asking Jesus into my heart when I got down on my knees.
Well, I went to
and
that
there,
same...
And there's the rub.
That's why I went to the same conference, and I had exactly the same question.
Yeah.
Well, what if it really wasn't true right then when I put the stake into the ground?
Right, exactly. And his suggestion doesn't solve that problem, and that is exactly the crux of the issue. The question is not, did I go through the motions of asking Jesus into my heart? The question is, was it an authentic request on my part? Wasn't it an authentic desire? Was it out of an authentic passion that I said to Jesus yes? Or was it out of some other motive? Because there are 50 reasons why we become Christians, and only one of them means we're a child of God. And so the real question is,
over the course of time,
exactly,
am I persevering in believing?
Right.
Am I really chosen by God, and does it show up in my life by the choices that I make?
And the uncomfortable truth is, that means that early on in my Christian life, there will be no assurance. It's going to take time. It's going to take living life. It's going to take getting enough time under my belt to watch myself, to see a pattern, before I can come to the point of saying, I get it, this is real. God really has a hold of me. This is something He's doing, not some weird sociological phenomenon or something that I'm manufacturing. This is something that God Himself is doing. But and it takes time to be able to see that.
But the good news, Jack, is over time you do know that.
Yeah, exactly.
Over time it isn't such a mystery. Over time I don't have to go out and look at a steak. Over time I know what's in my heart. And I am God's. And He is persevering me in my faith.
Right.
And that's a very, very cool thing for me to be able to state today. I know it's true. I can see now that it was true back then. I believed it be true, and He's carried me through here.
There's a passage in 1 Peter, and it's a difficult passage for me to interpret. I'm not sure I'm getting this right, but under one way of taking it, if this is the way, if this is what Peter means, he compares the testing of my faith to gold, pure gold that has been purified. And one way of taking it, of course, is that the purification of my faith is like the purification of gold. That might be what Peter is trying to say. But I'm actually inclined to think that actually what he's saying is, you want to know how valuable it is to reach a point in your life where you can look back on the trials and tribulations of your life that have led to the knowledge that you just talked about, Christine, the knowledge that, wow, I can have confidence here that I'm a child of God. That he's saying, you want to know how valuable that is? That's as valuable as the purest gold in the world. That's one of the most valuable things anybody could ever have.
No, it isn't one of the most valuable.
It is the most
valuable. Sorry, you're wrong.
Yeah.
It is the most valuable thing.
Exactly.
It's what stands out. It's what you stand on. It's the air that you breathe. It's the floor that you stand on.
Yeah.
It's it.
Yeah.
It's entering into a different world that you know.
And I think that's what Peter is saying in that passage. Is that very thing? You're not gonna get any more important gift in life than the evidence, the test, the proof, the authentication of a faith that means you stand to inherit eternal life. You can't get better than that.
And I fully expect, Jack, that my test is going to be very much tested in the years to come. And in 40 years from now, if I live that long, I'm going to look back and say, wow, my faith is even more real than I knew at age 44 that I am today. That I'll know it more then. And that's a good thing to look forward to. That's something that builds just incredible peace in my life, because there's something to stand on. And it becomes more and more and more solid, and not less so.
Yeah.
And what's kind of amazing to me as I see harder things in my life. In fact, there was this movie that someone was telling me about where these women were being persecuted by their captors. And one of the women said to another, is this making you hate them? And the other woman said, no. In fact, as I see them becoming more and more evil, as I see them being more cruel, I feel worse for them. I feel more heart toward them because they are so lost. And that's how I look toward the future for myself. I see cruelty and I expect cruelty to be a part of our world. It's kind of scary that's kind of, even in our present political situation, it seems kind of frightening to me. And yet, how I see people is with more sorrow and more grief that there's so much lostness. But it doesn't, that's authenticating my faith. It isn't taking me away from it. It's making me understand there's something good and there's something bad. And thank God He's got me in His hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jack, I wonder if I can take a short diversion here. Would that be okay with you?
Sure.
We were talking about, as parents, wanting our children to be true believers, have an authentic faith, and not just be people who have entered into a culture where they're faith just is something that they've that's not really real, that they're just in a culture that likes Christian values. And that sometimes our children may go in that direction just because they've been in that environment. And I think we want them to go in that direction because we want to be pleased, because we want to feel good about our parenting. And that's something I really would encourage parents to think about. Am I helping my child's soul, or am I protecting myself against what I fear? Am I protecting myself against children that don't look good to my church, to my elders, to my friends? Am I protecting myself from the pain of maybe feeling like I'm not a very good parent because my children aren't acting very good now? That's a really huge, it's a huge pressure. And one that we as parents really, really, really need to fight against. I think if we are parents who have perfect children, who are completely pleasing to us, I think it is then that we need to ask the question, do I have children who have learned just to be compliant, or do I have children who are understanding life, who are building up character, who are understanding their faith in a real way, or do I not? I was in a meeting rather recently with one of my children and all of his teachers. And they were saying to him, you know, you're doing really well in school, but we don't think you're a B-plus student. We think you can be an A student. And, you know, you're doing pretty well, but we just want you to do better because we think you have that in you. And on one hand, I applaud that. I want them very much to encourage my child to do really well. But on the other hand, I rose up against it. And what I said to them was, I would really love my child to be an A student. And I do think that he has the capacity to do that. But I don't want that at the expense of him determining for himself what life is about, for him thinking on his own, for him building a character and a personhood and a self that's real. I went through school, and I got a gold medal, Jack, at the end of school for being the best all-around student in that school. I think there were two of us that got that. And I successfully convinced myself and convinced them that I really was a best all-around person. But I was fooled. I was wrong. I was a person who had learned to please and to please well and to look good. I don't want that for my children. Sometimes I do, because it makes me feel better, because it makes it reflects better on me. But ultimately, I don't want to be reflected on well. If it means that my child loses their person and loses their soul, what I want for them is to be people who are loving, who are kind, who are giving, who understand. And that may not happen for years from now. But I don't want them to be people who, like me, have become fakes and don't even know it.
Mm-hmm. One way a person could hear what you're saying is that there are no valid choices versus invalid choices, that the important thing is that whatever a person does, whatever your child does, for example, it be really them. It be authentically them. Mm-hmm. Contrast what you're saying with that.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I think when my child is up against making a choice, for example, there was a teacher in his school who he did not like and all the students did not like, and he was saying to me, "Well, Mom, this teacher's just, you know, she's just a jerk. She just doesn't know anything. She's just, you know, it was all negative. And so why not treat her poorly?" And I said, "Well, you need to think about what's valuable to you. You need to think about what's loving. Do you want to be a person that's loving? Or do you want to be a person who is building hatefulness in the way that you think about and interact with this teacher and help other people interact with her?" I give him the ideas. I give him the thoughts. I head him in the direction of what I think is good, and I let him make his decision. He can fail. He can hurt her. He can be mean, but I instruct him toward what I think is good, and then he makes his decision. I want him to make good decisions. I don't think just because it's him, it's okay. But I'd rather him think about it and fail than not think about it at all. Because that is failure.
So with regard to academic or school success, then you might very well point out the benefits and the virtue of being successful and learning and gaining an education and the hard work and conscientiousness and responsibility that would go into that.
Right.
You might recommend that to him.
But I'm not going to write him.
Beat it into him just for the sake of...
No, I'm not going to write him. I'm not going to make that all that he is. And the only way that he can please me is when he has finally achieved that goal and lost sight of his own sense of his own choice toward wanting to make that himself. I was rode. I knew what I had to do, and I did it, and I did it well, and I pleased those around me. But it didn't come out of a sense of my own self, a sense of my own person, a sense of my own commitment. I wasn't compelled out of my own heart. I am now. It's changed now. But I was ridden to do that. I want to give my children instruction. I want to tell them what's right. I want to put in front of them information that will be helpful to them. And then I want them to make their own decision. Is that a hard road to follow? Yeah. Is that sometimes feel like a tightrope? Absolutely. But I try to walk it. I'm not going to give up.
And exactly that same problem can occur with respect to faith and spirituality and Christianity. I know when I was growing up, and I suppose it's still the case, there was a syndrome of the preacher's kid who would inevitably rebel against the faith in a way that a lot of other kids in the church would not. And I think it's really pretty easy to see where that syndrome comes from, because there's a great deal of pressure on a pastor, a minister in a church, to just kind of in a myriad of different ways communicate to their children, it is not an option for you to not be spiritual, religious, Christian kids. I'm the pastor. You need to behave. You need to fall in line.
Or come on, please behave. I don't want to get kicked out of my job.
Yeah. And if you can't make an authentic choice for yourself, then you got to make it for me. I mean, it basically is what you're talking about in that arena.
It's exactly what I'm talking about. And have you seen yourself be tempted in that direction as the pastor? You're speaking of yourself, of course, here and your children.
Well, you know, I think I would if I were in more of a pastor's, a traditional pastor's role. But our church is so different that the church gives me the freedom in a way that a lot of churches, I think, do not, to just see myself as just one more Christian bumbling along, struggling to understand the faith. And I study the Bible and I teach, but I'm really not...
You're a fellow bumbler.
I don't see myself... Pardon?
You're a fellow bumbler.
Yeah, yeah. I really see myself as a fellow bumbler. And that, therefore, takes a lot of pressure off. If people don't put me upon a pedestal, then I don't have to stay there or even be tempted to stay there, and then I don't have to put that pressure on my kids. I mean, as you know... I mean, this may seem outrageous to people, but as you know, my kids have, for the most part, not even come to our church.
Oh, my, you've just lost our whole audience, Jack.
But I did that deliberately. One of the decisions I made really early on is that my experience in Sunday school was that Sunday school worked really, really hard to give me the impression that Christianity was children's stuff, was infantile, it was for kids. Because they were working really hard to reach the kids, they would really dumb it down and even insult my intelligence as a child and give me the impression that this is kiddie stuff. And so I made a decision early on. I want to give exactly the opposite message to my children. I want to give them the message that Christianity is for adults, and I'm not even going to presume that you're even interested until you grow up enough to be an adult.
Now,
what
our audience could hear is you're not even training your kids about the gospel now.
I don't systematically, but we would take opportunity whenever crises would come up in their life. I mean, I have the luxury of my whole life is defined by my commitment to Christianity, and that you can't hide that from my kids. So I don't really have to say a lot for them to know where I stand. I mean, I'm
it's
a very
oozing
public
out and
Christian.
Spilling everywhere.
Yeah. And so I don't have to in any way tell the kids what I believe, because they are picking it up in a lot of different ways. And then I exploit that, and then I just take what opportunities I can as we face crises in life to to give them a I bring God into it. I mean, God is very much a part of how I would think about the crises in their life, and I think they know that. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I'm very, very heartened by my two older children and their own budding spiritual interest, and they seem vitally interested, and they're pursuing it on their own, and they've made it their own to a certain degree, and I'm very heartened by that. We'll have to see what happens with the younger kids.
And you're saying you just don't know where they are yet?
No.
They're still young.
Yeah, and you know, they're all of them are in God's hands. But, you know, duh. I mean, why that shouldn't be a shocking revelation. Of course they're in God's hands. And I have no control over the choice that they're going to make. And it would be a huge mistake for me as a parent to think, because I'm a Christian, God owes it, because I'm called of God, God owes it to my children to call them as well. And if I just play my cards right, I can guarantee that that's the case. There are no guarantees. And they may break my heart, but that's just part of the life we live.
So, Jack, I have a lot more I could say about children and our raising them and thinking about how to do it well. I think suffice to say right now is I think we as parents really need to look at, am I just protecting myself from what I don't, from the pressures of other people and not wanting them to think poorly of me, or am I really loving my child and bringing them up in a way that helps them really have an authentic faith,
exactly,
really think about and consider what's true in their own lives. That's very, very important. But getting back to where we started today is one of the marks of a believer is that I will persevere in my believing. And what we're saying is not that I will just clench my fists, dig my heels in, and just say, okay, I'm just going to stay here until the end of my life and just out of my own hard work get there. What we're saying instead is God is the one that perseveres us in our faith. Certainly there's evidence in our life, and we've talked a lot about that in the weeks past, of God persevering in our life and creating different things, making us want love, making us want justice, making us want to be compassionate and forgiving people, making us people who are truly spiritual. But that's his job.
Mm-hmm. I think a good way to summarize it is the parable that Jesus told. Behold, the sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seeds fell beside the road, and the birds came and devoured them. And others fell upon the rocky places where they did not have much soil, and immediately they sprang up because they had no depth of soil. But when the sun had risen, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And others fell among the thorns, and the thorns came up and choked them out. And others fell on the good soil and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. He who has ears, let him hear. And then he goes on to interpret that parable later. He says, hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is the one on whom the seed was sown beside the road. And the one on whom seed was sown on the rocky places, this is the man who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no firm root in himself, but is only temporary, and when affliction or persecution arises because of the world, immediately he falls away. And the one on whom seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. And the one on whom seed was sown on the good ground, this is the man who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. And as I understand what Jesus is saying there, he's saying there are a lot of people who respond to the gospel at some level, respond in joy, respond dramatically perhaps to it. But in the final analysis, many of them are going to fall away. The world is going to seduce them away, or the world is going to drive them away. But there's one group of people in whom that word, that seed takes root, the truth takes root, and it grows up, and as he calls it, it bears fruit. It changes their life. It changes them into a child of God rather than a child of the devil. They and only they are the true children of God. It's because the word that is in them is not just temporary. It's not just a flash in the pan. It's not just a temporary reaction to it. It's a permanent transformation of them that exists over the long haul. They persevere.
Over the years, the teachers of McKinsey Study Center have offered many classes, from studies in the book of Romans and Revelation, to a biblical view of history and culture, to sexuality and relationships. McKinsey has also presented conferences ranging on topics such as education, evolution, and the arts. Most of the lectures and discussions are available on tape and can be purchased for a modest fee. McKinsey also has a tape catalog to help you make your choosing easier. To order tapes or get a copy of the catalog, call McKinsey at 541-485-4801. Now, here again are Jack and Christy.
A few weeks ago in church, a woman came up to me and was very excited about Christianity at work. She's really thrilled about the radio program, and she said one of the reasons is because she gets kind of two sides of the issues. She said, with Jack, I get the biblical base, the kind of intellectual understanding of the scriptures. And from you, Christine, I get kind of a practical, real-life perspective. And she just loved the blend. And she went on to say that people who would never listen to Christine kind of get dragged in because they want to hear Jack. And people who would never listen to Jack kind of get dragged in because they want to listen to Christine. And I kind of like that. It feels like really very much a balance. Recently also, we received a letter in response to our request to get feedback about the show. And they said something very similar. It was very interesting to me that people had the same perspective. And it's exciting. This man says, yours is the program I wait and plan for each Sunday. The balance between Jack and Christine seems perfect. Jack presents his biblical knowledge in ways that ring true, and Christine counters his knowledge with the struggles that ensue in the actual practice of God's Word in our present culture, our world. That was really very much our intent when we began the program. In fact, as it began, just for some history for people, you, Jack, were invited to be the entire program. And then they decided that they needed a little bit of practical life entered in, and so I was kind of recruited to kind of try to
breathe life into it.
Breathe life into your words. I think that's kind of how it went.
Yeah.
And I really do think that it's been a really nice blend. I think that people appreciate both sides. We would, however, like to get more feedback, and so here we are, requesting that you guys give us feedback. Second kind of feedback that we're asking for is that you guys consider giving us financial contributions. If this has been very helpful to you, if it's something that you think helps you in your maturity, your growth, we would like you guys to consider, is there a contribution you can make? Now, I know sometimes when I'm asked to make a contribution that I think, wow, I don't have an extra $100, so I might as well not send anything. But the reality is, this program does not cost that much. I think it's about $1,200 a week to run on 10 different radio programs. We just took a consensus here, and that's how casual we are. We're not sure exactly how much it costs, but it isn't real expensive. Most of our expenses are actually going to the radio stations themselves to pay for the radio time. So even a small donation, $5, $10, is helpful to us, and we encourage you to consider sending that money to Christianity at Work, making checks. It's tax deductible, and you can make your checks payable to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. In the letters that we send each month, or we're supposed to send each month, we're starting to send a small envelope with a little slip that asks for a donation. It would be great if you guys, again, felt that this was helpful, that you maybe consider making a monthly contribution.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College. The McKinsey Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKinsey, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, The telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.